welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and the art of healing. Research on the health effects of stress shows us that the most corrosive to our health is stress associated with a feeling of helplessness. When animals feel that their situation is helpless, they let themselves die. I began studying Zen at San Francisco Zen Center when I was in my early 20s in 1972. To this day, the principles of Zen inform my life, so it's no surprise that after this year's election results, I turned to Zen again for perspective. The morning after Election Day, I noticed that none of my cats were aware that anything about the world had changed. Later, hiking in the woods, the sweet smell of the redwoods was as always. What came to me is that our task is always the same, working with things as they are. I called Zen Center and I asked Michael Wenger, who is a transmitted Zen priest, to come on the air with me today to discuss how to work with the stress of things not going our way. Michael Wenger is the author of 33 Fingers, a collection of modern American koans, and is editor of Windbell magazine. A Zen priest who received Dharma transmission from Sojin Mel Weitzman, he's a past president of San Francisco Zen Center. He's currently in charge of development and Dharma group support. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hey, Lena. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. We probably should begin by giving people a little bit of a frame about Zen Buddhism as opposed to other Eastern religions. One of the things that I think is important to mention here is that this is not just a philosophy. This is a physical or yogic practice that started, at least in China, 1,300 years ago? People have been sitting meditation before that in India. It's been a long, long practice.
We've been doing it for a long time. There's a, which is apropos maybe to this this radio show today, is in the 5th century, there was a Buddhist in Burma who wrote the Visuddhimagga, the way of purification. And he wrote, "The inner tangle and the outer tangle, this generation is in a tangle. Who can untangle the tangle?"
So that was when again? That was
in the 5th century.
5th century, so that is a long time. Anyway, as I was saying, this is not just philosophical. This practice has its base or its seat is in yogic or meditation practice.
It's being present in the moment, and if the moment looks black, how do you be present with black?
Well, but in addition to that, isn't a major part of Zen Buddhism actually having a meditation practice, having a daily or weekly or some kind of regular sitting practice?
Of course.
Yeah. Another important tenet in Buddhism is non-attachment. And I always think this is some sort of trick because it's not actually possible to be unattached. I mean, you can be detached or apathetic, but we live in a world of relationships and everyone is attached to the things they love. So I think non-attachment maybe is being open to what's coming next.
Well, of course, you have to be unattached to be unattached, of course.
Say that again?
You need to be unattached to being unattached, because you may find yourself attached, and then what do you do?
So what you're talking about is becoming an observer?
No, but to be present with whatever you are in whatever situation, and then try to let go. You're completely right. We're attached all the time. In fact, as soon as we say, "I'm unattached," you become attached to that. So you can't win in that way.
Well, and also I wonder whether, I mean, I always think it's important to unpack that concept because obviously people choose to practice Buddhism because it works for them. And clearly practicing every day, they become attached to practice.
Right.
So it may be, that's why I said I think it's kind of a trick to say unattached, but I still think it's a concept worth, you know, these ideas, these concepts are also, these principles are almost ineffable because they're experiential, I think, part of what makes Zen attractive and different from other philosophies and practices is that it is dynamic, and it has to do with your actual experience.
Right. It's the way we live our lives, not so much how we talk on the radio. But having said that, there's a poem that begins, "The great way is not difficult, only for those who are who are not attached to their preferences."
Well, there's a million different translations of that. There's some translations just say the way is not difficult, no picking or choosing, and some say don't be attached to your preferences. So do you want to comment on what it means to, if you observe, you know, here we just had this election and people have gone through grieving process because it didn't go the way. Okay, so how do you, in the context of this election, how do you practice non-attachment?
Well, what I always think is this is where my years of Zen practice come into effect. If you get what you want, then there's nothing to rub up against. But when things go differently than you want them to, then you have to say, oh.
So it's good to have things not go your way? Is that what you're saying?
Well, whether it's good or not, it's going to happen.
I think maybe another way to think of it is that things never go exactly the way you want them to be, because it takes all kinds to make a world, and we live in relationship with each other. So part of it may be the way we want it, part of it may not be, but I think the thing that makes people suffer is the sense that a lot is at stake,
mm-hmm.
and there's going to be a lot of suffering, and certainly part of Buddhist philosophy or Buddhism is compassion, hearing the cries of the world, doing good works. So it's very difficult if we are observing something that looks as if it's going against the very core of what we feel is constructive. But again, all of those things I just said are examples of believing in what I believe in and being attached to my ideas.
Right, and there's a teaching which is very much to that, the four Brahma Viharas, the four social emotions, which are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And the one that's thought of as the most important is equanimity. And each one of these four has something that's the opposite of it, and then something that looks like it but isn't. So, for instance, for equanimity, equanimity means the opposite of equanimity is one-sidedness. And then the near enemy of equanimity is not caring. Equanimity is not about not caring. You care, and then things happen, and then you show equanimity, and then you make your next step. So it's very important. It's not like, of course, we all have preferences, and we all want things to happen a certain way, and we work toward that. But when it doesn't go the way we want to, what do we do? Do we throw a fit, or do we keep going?
Well, and I think keeping going is important, and the delicate part of it is to manage to do this without here's another way to do this. If we move on to the next, and this is not a pun, but the next really large principle in Buddhism is the concept of shunyata, which is often translated as emptiness, but probably better translated as vastness, like the sky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's vastness. And people who meditate a lot and practice a lot sometimes find that in the process of doing it, they manage to cast off enough of their baggage so that they actually have moments of feeling this vastness.
Right.
And the thing that sort of sucks you back into things being more painful is where you begin to trust your perceptions and believe in what you believe in, and you have to move forward. The trick here is this issue of how you kind of walk forward knowing that even though you have a strong set of beliefs, those are your beliefs, and that there's someone else who has another set of beliefs, and that's their beliefs. And that doesn't stop you from doing what you believe is right, but there has to be, and I'm, you know, this is a kind of thing that's hard to talk about or describe, but it's important to maintain some perception of what belongs to you and that it's yours and that it is what you want and what you believe in, and you are going to work on it and work toward it. But that just because that's true for you, it doesn't mean it's so for everybody else. And that's the hard part, I think, about this sort of situation we find ourselves in.
I'm not sure if I followed you,
okay.
But I'm sure it was fine, but I'm not sure I followed you. But the part that I would say is, if you have some experience of emptiness, then you get attached to it. And the best experiences you have, you know, there are some people who have enlightenment experiences, and they tell you about them every 5 minutes.
Yes.
Rather, and to have an enlightenment experience is great, but then go on to the next. Don't hold on to emptiness or anything. Don't hold on to it. Think of what had happened if Carrie had won. Would we be ecstatic? Probably not.
No, probably not. We'd still have work to do. In fact, I think my favorite thing that I've read since the election is Molly Ivins had a column.
Oh, I heard about that.
And she talked about how in Texas, there's an expression that says, if a dog kills a chicken, you'll never be able to get that dog not to kill chickens once it has a taste for it.
Uh-huh.
And some friend of hers said, oh, no, there is a way to make a dog stop killing chickens. What you do, and I'll have to say to the people who are animal rights people to please, this is a story, is what you do is you put the dead chicken around the neck of the dog,
mm-hmm.
and you let it hang there and rot.
Right.
And the dog, you know, becomes, nobody wants to go near the dog, and the dog is suffering because this thing is around its neck, and that dog will never kill a chicken again. And interestingly, that metaphor was one that she used for what the American people are going to go through now.
Could be.
But what occurred to me is that in a way, when you sit Zazen, which is Zen meditation, some of it's joyous, some of it is wonderful, peaceful relaxation and touching you at the core of your being, and some of it is a rotting chicken around your neck,
yeah.
where you realize that you're hanging on to so many things that are hard for you.
That's true. You know, Thomas, my friend Marcia Angus, who you know, recently sent me a quote from Thomas Jefferson about the election, and it's very short. It goes, "A little patience, and we shall see the reign of witches pass over, their spells dissolve, and the people, recovering their true sight, restore their government to its true principles. It is true that in the meantime we are suffering deeply in spirit and incurring the horrors of a war and long oppressions of enormous public debt. If the game runs sometimes against us at home, we must have patience till luck turns, and then we shall have an opportunity of winning back the principles we have lost. For this is a game where principles are at stake." This is a letter he wrote in 1798. After the passage of the Sedition Act. Sounds just like today, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It's really amazing how much this just keeps happening. And it's also interesting to note that a lot of teachers who have come to the United States who have had an impact have also come from countries where they've experienced great suffering and terrible violence and stuff. So I guess what we can say is, to just go back a little bit, is that we're talking about, you know, non-attachment and emptiness and all these things that have a kind of open, spacious quality to them. And yet, that's not our everyday experience. Our everyday experience is that things will crowd in. And maybe the trick here, if I can be so bold, would be to just pay attention to whatever it is that, you know, as I said at the beginning, you work with things as they are and notice when they're hard, and then also maybe notice without guilt when, despite the fact that everything is hard, you feel great. That's okay. Yeah.
All right, courage. This is where courage comes in. Whatever the circumstances are, you go on with your life. And in fact, it's times like this in which we can be of more help to people than other times, where people can see if we just go about our lives and try to do our best and react to the situation, that is inspiration for other people. This is the time when we can be of most help. This is the time when those who have progressive ideas, who practice meditation, and who have care for other people, this is the time where we can be of the most help.
Well, there is a term, engaged Buddhism, which means that you have your practice that seems to be a quiet meditative practice, but that you engage yourself in the world and you do participate in action.
Yes.
And this, of course, from my perspective as a health educator, is very important because it is a problem when people feel really helpless, as I mentioned at the top of the show. This is a contributor to people becoming ill, hopelessness and helplessness. And it is always the case that there are choices.
Yes.
Even if it feels very, I mean, people who are terribly disadvantaged, who are living day to day, may not observe, you know, but there are often choices, even if the choice is, I need, despite the fact that the world is going crazy around me, or despite the fact that I'm having trouble feeding my children, maybe, like I remember, for instance, when we were all at Tassajar together, the monastery, that Huey Newton, this was right before I came, Huey Newton came and visited. This was before he became sort of a drug addict, but he came to visit, and one of the things he commented on was that he said, you know, when I was in prison, the only thing I had left was to sort of meditate and find a calm center in myself and to develop that capacity in myself to be in the moment. And you all are people who haven't had to be in prison, but you've imprisoned yourselves. You've gone to this monastery and you put yourself in this situation voluntarily to do this. He thought that that was sort of amusing and kind of cool at the same time. So I think that whatever's happening, that one of the ways to combat that sense of stressful helplessness is to pay attention to what you're doing and what choices you're making, even if they're tiny little choices.
You're completely right. You know, in the Heart Sutra, which we chant, which we use to chant three times a day, as you remember, it says, Avalokiteshvara, that's the person who hears the cries of the world, when practicing deeply Prajna, Paramita, wisdom gone beyond, perceive that all five skandhas, all the modes of perception, are empty, and was safe from all suffering. Being safe from all suffering, people may think, oh, nothing bad happens to you. I think safe from all suffering means that you don't add suffering on top of suffering.
No.
If suffering happens to you, you don't beat up on yourself or gnash your teeth. You just do what you can to fix it and keep going.
You also quoted something that Suzuki Roshi said about somebody coming to him with a problem.
Yes. If you have a problem, then you have a way to go.
Yeah, you have something to do. I just want to ID the show. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the air with Michael Wanger, who is a transmitted. That means he's allowed to teach. He's been anointed to teach. Zen priest in the Soto Zen tradition from San Francisco Zen Center. He's also vice president, was president of Zen Center. And we're talking about using the template of Zen Buddhist principle to help us in a situation where we have not chosen the way things are and we feel a sense of discomfort, how to practice with that, how to live with that. One thing that...
Can I tell another story?
Oh, you bet.
This is one of my favorite stories, which is around Swami Satchidananda.
Mm-hmm.
I heard this on the radio, actually on KPF, on WBAI in New York. It's the sister station. And he said, people come to me and say they're disappointed. And I ask them, who made the appointment?
Oh, yes, I remember that from your book. Yeah, which disappointment. One thing I was going to mention is I heard an interview with Mr. Rogers. It was obviously before he died, right after 9/11. And what he was instructing is that children who are watching the events on television, that they should notice who's helping. Notice the helpers. Yeah, I really liked it. He was quite a bodhisattva, is someone who's enlightened but sticks around to help everybody. And he certainly was one of those characters. That's Avalokiteshvara Kuan Yin, the one who hears the crying of the world, is a bodhisattva.
It's also finding encouragement.
Finding encouragement.
Yes, by seeing those who encourage.
Say that again, by seeing...
Well, if you see those who are helping in a disastrous situation,
yes,
you see
courage.
The upside and the way that you can go.
Well, one of the things that I, of course, thought about, and I don't know, I'm not sure what your ethnic background is. I have suspicions, but I don't know for sure. But I come from a Jewish background, and it's my generation, I think, in particular, always has the shadow of the Holocaust because it was just one generation back. And many people have been bannering around the idea that the thing that's frightening about the way that the politics are going right now is that it looks as though it's moving into a situation where our Constitution and the built-in, the things to protect a president from becoming a dictator are getting broken down, and that's very disturbing. So people start thinking, you know, at what point are we living in Nazi Germany, and what should we be doing if that's the case? Well, certainly a lot of people left Germany when they saw the writing on the wall. But there were a lot of people who stayed, and I know people whose families were helped out of Germany. I know people whose parents were escaped concentration camps because German soldiers helped them escape. So there were people who stayed in Germany and simply did something else. They stayed and they took care of people, which is an amazing thought to think of that, you know, that instead of, because I think a lot of people have just thought to themselves, okay, fly away now, go away, I don't want to be associated with this country. And clearly it's good to remember that there is this, again, to use Buddhism as a place to sit, there is this concept of loving kindness and compassion and hearing the cries of the world. And one of the opportunities in a situation like this is to stay and be part of the solution. And there's one other thing I wanted to say, which is that my understanding is that the way that feudal cultures collapsed was not by a revolution, but what happened was that people simply set up small towns in the shadow of the castles and started to set up commerce, you know, where they sold products to the castle. And pretty soon they had their own economy. And so they just, in other words, what I'm saying is that this underground economy developed, and it just eventually became the new mode. I mean, it became the new political scene, became the social structure. It wasn't an uprising. It was simply going off and doing things the way you knew that they needed to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, who knows what's happening? The story could be even worse than the one you've told, or it could be not so bad, but it's just to be wary of your stories and enact the best story that you can about yourself and helping others.
I think you need to explain that a little better. I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, whether it's an apt analogy about Germany now, I mean, I understand where one could go there, but I don't know if that's apt or not. It might be, it may not be. But to not leap to that or any other story, but to just see what you can do in the situation and see as things unfold if, in fact, it gets as bleak as that.
So what I think I'm hearing you saying is that, again, to go back to the idea of health, too, one of the things that makes human beings get sick from stress is that we have this capacity for running simulations.
Right. And that's very good.
So what you're saying is that one of the nice things about Buddhism and Buddhist practice and sitting meditation is to slow down your mind so that you're not running simulations and you're just taking care of all you have, which is the moment you're in.
Actually, that reminds me. When I went to Japan, I was struck by Japanese culture about three things. Number one, how safe it felt there, how at ease it felt on the street. And second, how they mixed everything up. There was a pachinko parlor and an ancient temple and a rice field all next to each other. But the third thing I noticed is, and this was not always the best, but I noticed that many Japanese people that I had dealings with, and they had several different versions of what was going on. And it was actually very subtle, because given how the situation went, they dealt with they used a different model. And so in a lot of ways, it was very sensitive and sophisticated, but there was a downside, and sometimes I felt like they were being less than honest. I don't know, I just threw that in there.
Did you know what you were, what made you want to tell that story, what it was that you were referring to?
Well, when you said different simulations.
Oh, just running simulations.
I think it's very important to have different models, because not to get stuck in one, but at some point you might have to say, well, I may want to see it a different way, but the information is telling me that this model is more accurate.
One of the tricky things about perceptions is that we learn and adapt in the presence of our stress hormones. So whether we're running away from a dangerous situation or running a simulation in our head about what could happen, or learning something new, in all those situations, the stress hormone cortisol comes into play, and that's how we learn. And one of the reasons this is tricky is that that hormone makes changes in the brain, so that if people continually have stressful, painful situations,
yes.
Then they tend not to let go of them very easily, because your body is kind
right.
of programming you to say, I'm never going to let this right. happen to me again. And so it's very real
yes, it
for
is.
Us, and it's very hard to unwind.
It is. Whatever we say, it's pretty deep. You know, what I'm noticing now is my mom, she's 83, and the past year or so, she's really having problem with her memory.
Mm-hmm.
And when she gets frightened, it's just really terrible. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's just very painful for her. She doesn't know what to do. She's anxious. She keeps, there's no way out. Occasionally, her memory is gone, and she relaxes. And
you mean she feels better when her memory's gone?
Well, when she realizes her memory's gone, she doesn't get nervous about it. She just, oh, my memory's gone. And it's actually quite wonderful. And she's more accessible than she's ever been.
Yeah, I've had a similar experience with my own mother, who has forgotten that she's mad at me. And so she's always very happy to hear from me. And it's very interesting, because I'm getting to experience her as just in the moment. And that's kind of one of the magical things about people with dementia, is that they are frightened because they don't know where they are, and they're just sort of dropped into the moment, but they're also very immediate.
Yeah, they can be, but if fright, and that's the thing about this, the election, if you immediately go into a fright mode, I mean, you should certainly to be sobered is realistic, but if you go into fright mode, you lock yourself up, and
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and we are having technical problems today. It's very interesting to be doing a show about what happens when things don't go your way and have everything not working. The piece of music you were supposed to hear, and I was listening to it, I guess you weren't, was Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, which I'm really sorry you couldn't hear. I was enjoying it, but it wasn't getting picked up at the station. Okay, well, we'll have to go back to that at some point.
Can I pick up on something you ended with?
Yeah.
I think it's very important that we be kind to ourselves and other people in times of stress, that we realize, oh, things are difficult, and not to beat up on yourself because you're not better than you are, or beat up on the world because it isn't following our dictation. But to be kind to ourselves, and to find a way to be kind to other people, because they're going through the same thing.
You know, I think that the thing that helps with that, in my observation, is that one of the problems is when things are bad, or when they're hard, or whenever, and we don't like them, we get angry. And the anger creates a boundary, creates a wall, puts up a wall. I've noticed that when people allow themselves to be connected with, if somebody opens themselves up enough so you can connect with them,
mm-hmm.
it's very easy to sort of take care of them and be kind to them. And I guess what I'm trying to say here is that we live in a world of relationships, and not only are we in relationship with the people, the rest of the people in the country who didn't vote the same way we did, but we have family members and all, and then as Buddhists, sanghas, we practice with other people. So it's about relationship. And one of the tricky parts about relationship is this ability to connect, the capacity to connect. And when people are in conflict with each other and there's anger,
yes.
the connection part goes away. And my experience has been that if you can stay with, and this is, again, very Buddhist, if you can just stay with the first feeling,
mm-hmm.
which might be, I'm really hurt,
yes.
and not go on to the anger, if you can stop the wheel wherever it is and immediately just be in that feeling without progressing to the next one and escalating it, that's good. In fact, I was talking to a group of other people in a sitting group that I'm in, and people were talking about the need from now on to really listen to what it, I mean, because we just have this wall about the other side. You know, we maybe have to hear what it is that they're trying, why they feel the way they feel, as painful as that is.
Maybe we shouldn't be so arrogant.
I just want to let people know, if you miss parts of today's show and you want to get a copy of this extremely fablunged show with all the technical problems in it, or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can go to my website, yourownhealthandfitness.com, or you can call 707-874-2772. If you want to look at the programs and the people at San Francisco Zen Center, it's SFZC, San Francisco Zen Center, sfcc.com. And if you're looking for a sitting group...
It's C-O-M, not C-A-L-M.
.com,
not .com.
Maybe it should be .com. If you're looking for other sitting groups, there are a variety of ways to do this. There are popping up now really small sitting groups, which I like very much. I'm involved in one of these myself, and they're much less formal. You can find some of these either by going, you can find small sitting groups and sitting groups associated with Suzuki Roshi's lineage at San Francisco Zen Center by going to their website. You can also go to David Chadwick's website, which is cuke.com. It's because he wrote a book called Crooked Cucumber about Suzuki Roshi, but cuke.com has a section where it has Dharma groups. You can look for his section there, and he'll have some listings like really small groups in Sonoma County and stuff like that. So if people want to find a place to sit, they can.
So as you were saying, it's not only our relationship to other people, but it's our relationship to our body. Like one of the things I learned early on in meditation, if I was having a long meditation day, and my knees would start to hurt. Sometimes I'd get angry at my knees and tense up. Guess
mm-hmm.
what? That didn't help.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's.
And then sometimes I said, okay, relax, try softer. And then it worked better.
That is one of the lessons of sitting for a long time. The other one is if you, you're better off staying still. If you start thrashing, it's more painful. And that's, I think, true in life, too, that the more you thrash, the more painful it is, and that if you can find some stillness in the midst of everything, even if it's only a tiny pinhole of stillness while everything else is not still, that's still helpful, too.
And I think it's very important in difficult times to renew your friendships,
mm-hmm.
just hang out with your friends,
mm-hmm.
to connect to that which is nourishing.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you very much so. You know, I want to talk about something else that I think might apply here, which is the idea of koans. Soto Zen practice, which is what we've been trained in, usually doesn't use koans, but more and more people are recognizing that we sort of do anyway. It's the Rinzai school, which is the other half of this sort of Japanese school of Zen that teaches koan practices. But koans are really interesting because they're kind of like the trickster. They kind of pull the rug out from under you. They're designed to kind of throw you off balance so that you have an experience. And you wrote a little book with American koans in it, and there are a lot of big famous koans. One of the things that is interesting about koan practice is that it's something that you can't sort of figure out, or, you know, it's kind of hard to, so you have to sit with it and sort of work on it. And it makes me think about the fact that this election and this whole situation with George Bush is like a gigantic koan. And there's a koan from your book, which is Isan Dorsey, who is everybody who's practiced at Zen Center for the last 25 or 30 years knows who he was and had an experience of being around him. He was an extraordinary person who was a transvestite and a drug addict and came to Zen Center and started practicing and ended up becoming a teacher. And he was really an amazing guy. Anyway, the koan from your book of his is everybody gets what they deserve, whether they deserve it or not.
Yeah.
Everybody gets what they deserve, whether they deserve it or not. And so it brings up this whole issue of karma. And I would like you to talk about a little bit about karma, because people, I think of karma in a very Christian way. They think if you behave badly, you're going to get it. And that's not really what it means.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about karma, but I'd like to tell one more Isan story first.
Yeah.
The day that Isan died, our friend Michael Jamvold went to see him. And Michael said to him, I'm really going to miss you. And Isan nodded, took a breath, and said, are you going somewhere? as for karma. Karma is the opposite of hopelessness. Karma says everything you do has effects, and everything is affecting you. So it's more like we're always participating with things. We're neither totally in charge nor totally a victim. Everything we do has effects, and everything everybody else does has effects. And the combination of these effects results in what happens. So that means that there's always hope. There's always what you do will have some result. It may not show up in this election, but it will show up somewhere.
Yeah, I agree. And we also, it's that sort of feeling of we don't actually know what's going to happen. We're running simulations, which again makes you sick. Think simulations, sickness. But we also don't know what's going to happen. And you know, if you want to run simulation, you could run the other simulation, which is that Bush runs the country into such a mire that people then elect somebody really progressive. We can hope. I mean, it's a nice thought. But in any case, the concept of karma, the way you described it, I think is really wonderful. I always think of it as like ripples in the water. You know, when you move your hand in the water, it creates a rippling effect. And so it has an effect on the surface of the water, and then it has an effect somewhere else further down the line. There's no way to avoid that.
And then also the effects of you not manifesting as best you can would have been a lot worse. You know, a year ago it looked like Bush was going to win by a landslide.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, yeah. And it's not really about Bush. I mean, I don't want to make this as a... I don't want to beat around the bush, so to speak. It's about what you do. And everybody faces adversity in their life. Everybody. Health adversity, friends dying, not getting what you want. And what do you do? How do you deal with it? And if you're not so self-absorbed, you do your best and keep going. Learn from what happened. And in fact, it's been my experience that when things have gone well and people have admired me and given me things and all of that, I didn't learn much.
Mm.
But when I messed up, I learned.
Yeah, I think we all forget about that. We forget about the fact that we learn from our mistakes, that's actually how, that's one of the major ways. I think learning also can happen in an atmosphere of great love.
Sure.
But it does happen a lot when things are hard, or we just really did, you go try something out. And we were little, you try things out and you discover, okay, well that was hot. Don't want to do that again. Right. You know, another thing I think that is difficult for people is, and it maybe happens a lot on the left, is this idea of hearing the cries of the world, but hearing the cries of the world without projecting. Do you know what I'm saying? In other words, I think that people...
Well, I don't think I know what you mean. In the Brahma Viharas I talked about, with sympathetic joy, loving kindness, equanimity, the one is compassion. And the opposite of compassion is not wishing someone the best. And then there are two near enemies of compassion. One of them is saying, oh, I feel sorry for them, in which you feel superior because you're not suffering the way they are. It may look like compassion, but it isn't.
Yeah, go ahead.
And the other near enemy of compassion is saying, wow, their life is really depressed, so I'll get depressed. That's self-indulgence. That's not compassion.
Well, it's also not very effective. It's hard to help somebody when that happens. But I think there is a place for empathy. And I think that people who do work in the helping professions are sometimes advised not to be empathetic because they get burnt out. But I think that if you're empathetic and you take care of yourself, that empathy can be a great gift to people.
Yeah. Empathy is very important. And, of course, not being too tied to the results.
Yeah.
I mean, you can be empathetic for someone and not be devastated when it doesn't go well.
Yes. But, you know, what I was thinking about particularly is, this is dicey, but I sometimes get calls from, it doesn't happen very often, I have to say it doesn't happen very often, but when I do a show about nutrition and I talk about vegetarianism versus being an omnivore, people who are vegetarians, who are animal rights people, who are very political, sometimes will call. I get maybe one or two calls a year. And one of the things that I sense about, I'm an animal rights person as well, even though I'm not a vegetarian. And the point is to be able to hold the feeling of identify. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that people identify with innocence, whether it's in an animal or somebody who's suffering. We identify with people who are innocent, and we want to help them. And one of the things that can get in the way, can be devastating, is that if you're projecting your own innocent, pained person that's inside you onto the outside world, you may not be perceiving things correctly. It's very difficult. I mean, we don't get mad at dogs for eating meat. You know, it's kind of a strange. Well, and on the other hand, if you do eat meat and you do have these feelings about animals, yes, it is painful and sad to eat animals if you feel them as being equal to you, which I do. There is a sadness that goes with it, but I'm saying that people have a tendency to perceive other people's suffering, and they project their own suffering onto other people or onto other creatures.
Let me say, this is a good point to talk about how to use koans.
Oh, good.
Maybe the first koan that's, and as earlier you said that Soto Zen doesn't use koans and Rinzai Zen does, or we just use them in a different way.
I think so. Yeah.
But one of the ways that I use and teach koans is, I'll give you an example. The first case of the gateless gate, the Mumon Khan, is does a dog have the Buddha nature?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is moo. Moo can mean no or nothing. So this is what the very first way to enter a koan is to say, what's going on intellectually? Not to set the whole story, but what's going on intellectually? So you could say, what is Buddha nature? What is having it? And why a dog? I mean, that's what comes up from those first sentences. What is Buddha nature? What is having it? And what is a dog?
Mm-hmm.
And just a very kind of cursory beginning level is, it's not about a dog, it's about you.
That's right.
And then what is Buddha nature? And what is having it? And then sometimes I say, what if you ask the dog, does the human have Buddha nature?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? And that's just the beginning way of entering. And it's looking at the distinctions you make between yourself and a dog, between Buddha nature and not, between possession and non-possession. So that's just the beginning way to approach a koan.
Well, you can also just sit with mu, which is that, going back to that idea of emptiness, which doesn't have to be a negation. It can be a negation, or it can be vastness.
Right.
It can be potential. It can be...
Just going with mu, just the sound mu, is also a great entrance.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just saying a way to first begin koan study is, mm-hmm. Is to look at what on the surface it's talking about, just as a surface entrance, mm-hmm. rather than just saying mu.
I just wanted to let people know you're listening to Michael Wenger from San Francisco Zen Center. We're talking about how to practice with things not going your way. And I'm Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. So what is the value, do you think, of that kind of practice?
To let go of your ideas.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I like about it, too. I really like koans a lot. You know, there's... Some of my favorite ones are, I love the one, and I'm not going to tell it right, so maybe you'll tell it right, but the student, you know, asking Basho about the moon, and Basho saying, if you're pointing at the moon, you've already missed it. I think I've said that wrong. Is that kind of right?
Well, it's kind of right. It's don't mistake the finger for the moon.
Don't mistake the finger for the moon.
If we look at the finger, everyone looks at it from a different place, but the finger is actually just pointing at the moon.
And the other one I really like is the story about... student going to have tea with a teacher, and the teacher takes his cup and he fills it and fills it and fills it, and pretty soon the tea is running all over the table, and the student is like, whoa, you know, what are you doing? And the teacher says, you should come back to me when your cup is empty.
Mm-hmm.
You've come here when you're full. And I think I feel that in my own practice. Somebody comes in and they actually want to talk about some principles in terms of health, and they want to understand their situation from a different perspective, but they have so much already going on. They have so many ideas that I can't say anything to them. So what I usually do at some point is I say, okay, look, let's try this. I'm just going to tell you what I think might be useful for you to have as information, and don't worry about it right now. Mm-hmm. Just listen to it or make notes or whatever, but don't even think about it or worry about it right now. Just have it, and then later you can like look at it again.
Yeah, that's good.
But that's the problem, is that people come with so much going on already that you can't experience, you don't can't let anything from the world, and that creates hunger. That creates a kind of panicky hunger in people if they can't let things in.
And then there's also the problem that I have is I don't want to listen to what they have to say. I want to tell them the answer.
Well, yes.
It can go in both ways. But to really just be present with the person is the most important thing. And then the truth will come out.
Well, and we communicate so much with our bodies. I think that that's the way Zen is transmitted, is not just with words, but by, you know, one thing that I remember, I mean, I've just recently come back to sitting with people that I sat with when I was in my 20s. And one of the things that Darlene Cohen said, because she's starting a Zen center in small Zen center in the Russian River area, is that she and Tony had thought about leaving the area and moving somewhere else where it was kind of frontier Zen, where there was less teachers and less places to practice. But they felt this sadness at leaving all these people that they had spent so much time with, their bodies in proximity. I mean, they mean literally just sitting together, talking together, practice, you know, having bowing, you know, whatever, eating meals together, just all that sort of time physically together with the kind of quietness and attention. It's something that we didn't get in our families, really.
That's what's so nice about you asking me to be on the show. I have more time to reconnect with you, Lena.
Aw, thanks. Thank you. Well, see, that just took me off guard. That was sweet. Thank you. But anyway, the reason that I wanted to sort of bring these concepts to people, I mean, I don't know how, I noticed that when I do shows where I talk specifically about, you know, eat this way, take these vitamins, or this is how, you know, this is your body on stress, this is what happens when you exercise, this is what happens when you eat sugar, that people tend to be more riveted to the show because they actually want to be told what to do.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that I'm concerned with people being exposed to some of these principles is that I feel very strongly that people benefit in their lives from a more dynamic, personalized, engaged experience of their own lives.
Yeah.
And I think that part of the reason we're having a crisis with health is because people have a difficult time actually experiencing things from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
They're not able to hear what their own body is trying to tell them. They don't have a relationship with themselves. And I think that meditation practice is, it doesn't have to be Zen. I think any meditation practice that puts you back on your feet and fills you back in, you know, up into your fingertips so that you feel the inside of your body, that's one of the major ways that you can protect your health. I mean, many people in our group have gotten sick. And that isn't to say that people don't get sick when they're conscious. But I think that you have choices. You have different choices when you are sick. If you are embodied, because you can, among other things, you don't have to do just what the conventional medical people are telling you to do. You get to choose how you want to live your life, how you want to run your illness or your wellness, or even that junction in between, because who's to say who of us are really well or who's sick?
Yeah, well, anyhow, that's well spoken. About who's to say who's healthy and sick, we can all say, but that all that went before is learning about yourself and learning from that and letting your body and the information of your body teach your body what to do is right on.
Well, I think that you have to become your own expert. And the odd thing, I think, about Buddhist practice is that you know, like I said earlier in the show, if you're sitting with a rotting chicken around your neck, one of the things you begin to see is sometimes it's possible to go through a period of feeling very self-conscious. When you start to sit again and you start to interact with other people, you start to observe yourself and you feel like, oh no, why did I just say that? What was I doing? You know, and you become a little self-conscious, but there are opportunities to sort of step off and be in a kind of more open space where the world sort of comes in, you get to feel things coming in, and you also begin to just trust your next footstep.
Well, we all have a rotting chicken around our neck. We're all getting older, and we're all going to die. And And that's just the way it is.
Well, that's actually why I started practicing in my 20s, is I thought, geez, I really want to be able to be able to let go and die well at the end of my life. I don't want to be one of these people that can't let go. And so I started practicing, thinking that it would take a whole lifetime to get good at that, to jump off. I think that we're going to have to wrap it up here in a minute, because I think we have to give the station a chance to play some, I think this is true, maybe I can get some communication from my board op. Do we need to stop now in order to play? Oh, so we can continue on. Okay, we can continue on is the words. I'm hearing voices.
We're demonstrating how to continue in the middle of adversity.
Yeah, this has been quite a show. I haven't had a show this chaotic in a long time. It's really been, it's amazing. It's kind of ironic, too. Why don't we spend the last few minutes talking about the relationship between practitioners practicing together and why that's important? Because a lot of people, I think, learn to meditate and they begin to develop a meditation practice on their own. And I think that there's real value in doing that. But I think there's a tremendous value, not only just because, you know, a lot of people seek out a sangha because they didn't have good families or something, but it's more than that. It's a very unique kind of relationship. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I just got the latest issue of Tricycle, where they asked me to write about competition in sangha and comparison. There's a story which a very famous teacher, Dogen, was asked, what happens when you find yourself in disagreement with somebody? What should you do? Should you try to win? Or should you give up? And Dogen says, become disinterested, and the other person will become disinterested.
Really?
It's pretty interesting.
You mean let go of your attachment to your ideas,
yeah,
and the other person will let go too?
Yeah.
I'm going to try that.
Because, you know, it's so much about it as I want to win. I want my, it's not even about the idea, it's just that I won. So, but actually practicing with people is very good, because people are so difficult to be with. And, of course, you're so difficult for other people to be with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a double whammy. It's like I think that other people are so inconvenient, but I'm very inconvenient to them.
That's, of course, the more negative side to it. But the other, and that is, but it is remarkable. I mean, the thing that I keep noticing is that when you actually try to live in an intimate relationship to somebody, and then you also have your practice community, it's, you begin to understand that people really do see the world and experience it differently than you do. It's hard to believe, because we have language and we kind of think we're all kind of on the same page, and then you begin to pay attention, and the more you pay attention, the more you realize we're not. And sometimes you are, but a lot of times you're not. And that isn't something to be upset about, because it can also be an incredible opportunity for learning.
Yes. You know, sometimes in Asia, the temple, they don't talk about Buddhism, they talk about big roofism, that the temple is a place where everyone can meet. Everyone can be together. And that's very inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a matter of Buddhists or not Buddhists. But now to get Republicans and Democrats to be under the same roof, I don't know.
I don't either, but we, as I said before, we don't know what's going to happen. I do know what's going to happen now, though, which is that I am actually running out of time, so I have to let you go, dear Michael Wenger. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Leah.
Michael Wenger is vice president at San Francisco Zen Center. The website for San Francisco Zen Center is sfzc.com.
.org.
Oh, it's .org?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Thanks, Dana.
Anyway, people can try it a different way. Thank you, Michael.
Okay, bye.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information, or you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows or information about guests, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.com. Also, information on subscribing to the new newsletter, Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine. Your Own Health and Fitness is a co-production of Your Own Health and Fitness, 8.5x11 Productions, and KPFA FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Eddie Pei. Thank you so much. See you next time.
2 o'clock, and you're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno.